Today is Monday, July 27th, 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon is Mary Boyes. Session number is 98-5, and it's titled Two Stories of Christian Origins. Let's listen in.
For the sake of the person running the tape, let us start. My name is Mary Boyes, and although I'm a native of this part of the world, I grew up in Seattle, lived in Spokane and Portland at various junctures of my life, I now live in exile from the Northwest in the Big Apple of New York City. So I am trying to tell myself that isn't it wonderful it's not this hot in New York, where the humidity level would also be about 100% and the buildings would give off all kinds of heat. I would like in particular to welcome those of you who just arrived today. I think it's nothing short of heroic to get off the boat and the bus and the orientation session and on a hot day like this to come in at 3:45. And so with all the power vested in me by Holy Mother Church, which is none, I hereby absolve you if you fall asleep. So how many of you did arrive today? If you could just a little show of hands. Well, one intrepid soul.
Two
intrepid souls. Let me give you just a very brief introduction, both to this session, but also in a sense to what I've been doing. This is my second week here on the teaching staff. And what I've been trying to do in the classes that I have been assigned to is help people think of a more imaginative, but also a more accurate way of understanding who we are as Christians, because largely through biblical scholarship and better historical studies, we have a more accurate understanding of what Judaism was like during the time, particularly during the time of our origins. So last week I did various vignettes and topics out of that. I began with sort of a new look at the Pharisees and talked a little bit about some of the historical setting of the New Testament, something about what first century Palestine was like, filling in the picture then for the next day of the Jewish Jesus and so forth. But today I'd like to do a big picture, and I'd like to do the big picture in two parts. One, and I will try to spend less time on the first than on the second. The first part has to do with trying to see if we can agree upon a certain consensus. I'm not going to take a vote, and there may be differences because of where you grew up and whether you were, you know, what kind of a church you were raised in, if indeed you were raised in the church. But to what extent we all inherited, as it were, a certain, what I will call a storyline or a very general narrative about the relationship between Christianity and Judaism, although we didn't think about it specifically as such. And then look somewhat discerningly at that account and then see what might be a more, what I think is a more accurate and even a truer portrait, both of Judaism and of the early church. And I have a handout for both of those. It's kind of like, you know, Ash Wednesday or Palm Sunday. Christians like to come and they can get something. You can take it home or you can leave it here as you wish. It's my only handout of the week, so I shouldn't lead on as if I'm going to give you something new each day. I mentioned at the beginning this is part of a long project that I've been working on. My field fundamentally is the intersection of religion and education. So I have a special passion for how educators and preachers and teachers of all sorts in the church have to, I think, realign some sort of fundamental understandings. So this week and last week gives me a chance to try out what I really haven't tried out in this format at all before. So that makes you somewhat the product of experimentation, but it's very helpful for me as a teacher. And the manager of the bookstore has instructed us that we are to push whatever we ordered, so, or whatever books we've done. And I noticed that Roberta Bondi's just as shameless as I, so, you know, I'm in good company here.
I've worked with all the books are sold out anyway.
Okay, well then, since you can't read Roberta Bondi's book, try the next best thing. Anyway, I do have a very modest volume in the bookstore called Jewish Christian Dialogue, One Woman's Experience. And this project is interrelated to this book, but it's a much fuller version of that. So I'd like to start, since I don't, I think as a teacher, you have a better experience when you have full participation. And I should tell you that this woman sitting in the purple here, who just arrived, was my master teacher when I started teaching high school in Spokane in 1969. We were both younger then. But I will try not to offend some of the fundamental canons I learned back in my youth.
That means you'll have to restrict the puns.
That's true. We were terrible punsters together, and so God in her wisdom has separated us by a continent. So what I would like to ask and you to think about for a moment is, if you could reduce to basics, like to one paragraph, the story you think you learned about how we got from, say, from creation to the church. If you had to, let's say you're trying to explain this to seventh graders, people who have, you know, they're beginning to get a fundamental sense of time. You can use a few, you can count on the beginnings of some abstract thinking and so forth. But what's the basic storyline? What's the relationship, say, between the Old Testament and the New Testament? Why did Jesus come? Where does Jesus fit in all of this? And I would like to ask you to do this with a few of your neighbors for the moment, since it's sort of a large group just to launch into people speaking singly. And what I'm asking you is not necessarily to report what you now think, but the way you think you learned it along the way. What the story you kind of grew up with now that you have a little chance to reflect on it. So this is not a matter of being right or wrong. I mean, maybe you don't like the way you learned the story, but it's the story you learned. We're not accountable for that. Does this make sense? Okay, would you try it just with a few of your neighbors, two or three of you? You know, why did God create us, and what was the call, what was the covenant, what was it all about, and what happened to the covenant, that kind of thing. You don't have to use highly theological language. I understand English perfectly well. But just the story as you have learned it, and as you might tell it, say, to a seventh or eighth grade. Or to a group of adults who know nothing really much about the church. Okay, think about 4 minutes. Push the pause button for a moment. Stay in your groups. Rather than just take feedback at the moment, what I'd like to do is to distribute among you one rendition of this account. Now, this has sort of been worked over and probably isn't necessarily the vocabulary you used. I'm going to go over it briefly in the group as a whole, and then I would like you in your groups to say, does this account that I'm distributing bear any similarities to the conversation that you've had among you? In other words, is there some kind of congruence between the basic drift of your conversation and this basic account? I should tell you that I made this up, that is to say, I wrote this and I don't intend necessarily for it to be exactly as we all learned it in all its particulars. So let me read it out loud. Sometimes on a hot day, this helps us to keep some attention. God, creator of all life, called the Jewish people to be his people. I didn't learn it in inclusive language, so I kept it that way, right? Or expansive language. Making a covenant with them that they might be a light to the nations. Yet they failed to keep this covenant faithfully, so God promised to send them a Messiah. Jesus, the long-awaited Messiah, foretold by the prophets, preached a gospel of love and freedom that transcended the confines of the law, especially as interpreted by the Pharisees. He was crucified at Jewish hands because they rejected his message and denied his divinity. Thus, quoting the letter to the Hebrews, God spoke to our ancestor in many and various ways by the prophets, but in these last days he has spoken to us by a son whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he created the worlds. So, Christianity, the religion of Jesus, not only originated in Judaism, but fulfilled it. The divinity of Christ was the defining issue, the basis for the break with the synagogue. By 70 of the first century, the two were definable religions, clearly differentiated from each other. Thus, they went their separate ways, with Christianity flourishing in the Roman Empire, while Judaism diminished in importance. Now, at least as I received versions of this story, there were some what I would call some corollaries. Nobody ever marked these as corollaries, mind you, and nobody ever called this the conventional account. And I still hear these, by the way, with some regularity. The Jews did not take to heart the warnings of their prophets to obey the covenant. Their covenant is therefore abrogated. The Jews did not correctly understand the prophecies about the Messiah. They expected a royal, a glorious Messiah. They could not recognize Jesus as the Messiah. I hear that every Advent without fail. After the 6th century before Christ, Judaism, after the exile in Babylon, which began in 587, Judaism was legalistic. It placed an undue emphasis on laws of purity, and there were all kinds of minute regulations about such primitive practices as animal sacrifice. And then the Pharisees, source of so much opposition to Jesus, represented the epitome of legalism. We'll just take a minute in your groups to do a sounding. How does this account square with what you received? And then I'll take some feedback from the group as a whole. I know there hasn't been quite enough time for every group, but an hour being very modest, I'm going to interrupt. Could I just get a sampling about, you know, to what extent, obviously it took me, I had a little longer to write this than you did to think of this in your group, and I sort of knew what I was about, and perhaps my instructions were a bit vague to you, but how does this match up with the storyline of Christianity as you more or less received it? You think it's okay? Other people?
Mine was much more oriented toward Adam and Eve and individual fall at the beginning. I mean, it
right.
Didn't involve the Jewish nation nearly as much in my first story.
And I think probably accurately that's how my, I mean, I was trying to do it in a page, but you're right, I think about it. There was a lot of emphasis in my childhood about Adam and Eve sinned, and the sin of Adam and Eve had some way, you know, there had to be some means of reparation for that terrible breach between God and humanity and so forth. Okay, that's a good correction. Roberta?
Where my heart was as a teenager was with the Unitarians, but the Methodist church that I was brought to, this is probably exactly accurate for what I was taught as a teenager in the Methodist
church. But not what you would have heard in the Unitarian.
It wouldn't be what I've heard in the Unitarian Church, but this would be the sort of standard, polite, middle-of-the-road Protestantism. And we wouldn't have heard much about Adam.
Okay, right. Okay, different traditions emphasize the fall, right. Anybody else?
Well, I had remarked that the emphasis that Jesus was for the whole world, therefore the pagans were coming into the church, and the Jews just simply got to get on the train. They missed the train,
it's gone.
They became irrelevant rather than even thinking about them.
All right, they just don't appear in the story much after, right? You know, after the death of Jesus, they're kind of out, or at least after Pentecost or something, yes.
I think the first part is very close to what I heard. I'm not sure the corollaries, they perhaps are too strident a way of saying what could have well have been there, but I didn't pick up as emphasis. Again, embedded under the story, they
right.
may have been there.
Okay. What about the corollaries? Anybody? Stephanie?
We talked about whether or not we learned that their covenant was abrogated, and we said, well, we kind of learned that.
We certainly didn't learn that word.
Well, yeah. No. But we learned that the new covenant fulfilled the old covenant, and then we just kind of didn't learn what happened to the old covenant. It was that, well, the new one is what counts, and so.
Yeah, so they were out of the picture. Now, just to show you that, while I did make this up, I did try to be attentive to what I think a lot of us learned along the ways, and I think it crosses a lot of denominational lines. Here are some things that I have found in some fairly recent pastoral commentary, some spirituality that comes from various people. This was from a pastoral commentary on the readings for the first Sunday of Advent last year. The Jews had great expectations of a Messiah who would be a political leader, a warrior king. They waited for thousands of years and then failed to recognize him in the baby born in the stable while all the world slept. Think of this, those of us who sing a hymn that I personally find, actually, it's probably number one in my hit parade of beloved Christian hymns. But if you just think of the lyrics here, O come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel that mourns in lonely exile until the Son of God appear. You begin to think what sort of accumulated effect all of these things are going to have on our understanding of ourselves in relationship to Judaism. Here's from a recent book on spirituality called Galilean Journey. It is clear from the Gospels that Jesus exhibited an intimacy with God that was totally unheard of, even to the Jewish people. This intimacy with God was at the very core of the uniqueness of Jesus. Next one, also from a book of spirituality now around the passion of Jesus. In the world as Jesus found it, human beings were enslaved by certain absolutizations. They were under the yoke of absolutization of religion, of tradition, and the law. Religion was no longer the way in which human beings expressed their openness to God. It had crystallized and stagnated in a world of its own, a world of rites and sacrifices. I was reading along in a commentary about the wedding feast at Cana, the second chapter of John's Gospel. Again, this is not from a scholarly book. This is from a kind of a commentary that the people in the churches who are serious about their faith might pick up. So the commentator writes, John tells us that Jesus asks the servants to fill 6 stone jars for the Jewish rites of purification. Water and the purification rites are referring to certain religious customs of Jesus' day. From that time on, Jesus' day, religion will no longer be based on the law and constant ablutions, a sign of their uselessness, or on the observance of precepts followed under the fear of punishment and guilt. This is precisely what John is telling us. The presence of Jesus is the epiphany of this new and different God. Not a God of fear and punishment, distant from us and delighting in sacrifices, but instead a God who is close in the setting of a feast, sharing our joys and our concerns. I think if I had to say, what's the most prominent sort of subtext that accompanies this conventional account is that the God of the Old Testament was a God of fear and punishment, and the God of the New Testament, the God of Jesus, was a God of love. That has a very long life in the church. That's enjoyed, has a lot of staying power. Now, again, there's too little time to really do back and forth as might be ideal, but as you look at this conventional account now, are there some things that make you uncomfortable, either because you know something different, or because you're not sure why, but it just does make you kind of uncomfortable? That if this is the basic way we Christians understand ourselves, there's some misgiving in you, even if you can't articulate it fully.
The second sentence, yet they failed to keep this covenant faithfully. It's uncomfortable because it's like a failure, so can't really rules your, kind of a just desserts sort of.
Okay, all right, yes.
I felt some of the corollaries just bothered me because I felt they were almost anti-Semitic.
All right.
Maybe it's just because that's...
I tried not to write anything I hadn't heard or read in my considerable number of years. So, but that
was my feeling.
Right, that's your feeling. It's also mine, by the way, so yes, okay.
I think making the Jews so one-dimensional at that particular time is just unreal. it's easier to cast them aside if we do that. It's like a parody rather than reality.
See, this is very, now, let me speak to you as a teacher. It's a lot easier to teach a simple and clear account to somebody than it is to create an engagement with a more complex, ambiguous account of Christianity. And, you know, there's a lot of desire on the part of people in the churches for clear answers. When did Christianity begin? And what exactly differentiates us? And, you know, why is Jesus the one who was the most intimate with God? And so on and so on and so forth. And also, you know, frankly, you have to have a lot more knowledge to teach another kind of view. And you know, most of the people who teach in church or volunteer settings are people who are pressured into it out of their own goodwill. And they don't have a lot of time for learning. You know, let's be very realistic here. So, anything else about this?
A lot of this is generational, too. You know, that those of us who are older remember, Martin Luther was one who condemned the Jews to a certain extent. The Jews were condemned in Germany, and it has only been in the last few decades that we've started to really look at the Jewish people as, hey, this is not right, this condemnation, and we're picking up bits and pieces of it from good sources, from Martin Luther, for one, and then, of course, the tragedy of the Holocaust. And then I think younger people probably haven't had that kind of a background, the hatred of the Jews, or the rejection of the Jews, and there's been an attempt recently to say, you know, this isn't right, this hate isn't right, this rejection isn't right, let's see what the real story is.
One way to look at that, it seems to me, if you think of this conventional account as being somewhat typical of what many of us heard somewhere along the line, we were never taught explicitly to hate the Jews. But what the effect of it is that we sort of declare the Jews a non-people. You know, they had missed the train. The train had left. We were on it, and we're rolling. And the Gentiles, the pagan, so to speak, had come into the fullness of Revelation, and it gave us what I think is. I don't think we necessarily were anti-Semites. I'm not saying anti-Semitism doesn't exist, but I don't think that's really what the church was teaching. But we really sort of learned that Judaism had no reason to exist anymore. And I think there's no question about it that the Holocaust has set us to thinking in a new way. So too, I think, has biblical scholarship. Because one of the things that you can say is that after the first sentence, and maybe the last sentence of the first paragraph, since I stole it fair and square right out of the first verse of the first chapter to the Hebrews, all the rest of this is really just not historically accurate. And that it, in some cases it's just downright wrong, and other cases it's a gross oversimplification. So there's another. So my passion for this project is not simply because I want us to relate better to the Jews. While I certainly hope that that's the case, and I've had the privilege of working collegially with Jews for quite some time now, that is not my primary interest. My primary interest is we as a Christian people have to get our story straight. And the consequence is that I think it will give us a healthier sense of identity. Now, I also know, as a student of scripture, as a teacher, and so forth, that it's a lot easier to be critical of what was received and to see the shortcomings than it is to teach an alternative. So I have been trying my hand for the last year to see if I could do an alternative account. One hopes a more accurate account, a better account. I would have to tell you that I first tried to keep it of this length. I've been teaching for a long time. I know that simplicity is a great gift of a teacher, but you can only make things so simple when they're complex. So I have now gotten it down to a back and front of the same sheet. it still reads a little too, there's a little too much that sounds too theological in terms of academic prose, and I would be happy to have any kinds of amendments and so forth. I have run this by people who are in more specialized areas than I am, and they give a few suggestions here and there. I can't tell you how many times I've edited this bloody thing, but that's the fun of it. Because every time I have a chance to, I haven't actually had a chance to do this with too many groups of people, so it's a real privilege to try this with you. So on this hot afternoon, we really have to be using our Everybody have access, have fun? Their extras maybe you could just pass them. One more over here. You know, of course, I think one of the variations of Murphy's Law is as soon as you have run it off the Xerox machine, you see a typo. No matter how often that you have checked this, because every time you read another variation on Murphy's Law is every time you edit one mistake out, you somehow add in another. But at any rate, so, but perfection is not all it's cracked up to be. So, okay, I'm gonna try reading this, and then I'll give you some time, maybe again in small groups, just to kind of chew over it. And I apologize that this is a little too much like eating a full course dinner at 4:15 on a day when it's about 100 degrees. But just think, Jesus walked the hot, dusty roads of Palestine. That's a fact. As one of my friends would say, that's a fact, you can look it up. God reveals the divine presence in many and various ways to all peoples. In a distant recess of history, nearly 4,000 years ago, the Holy One entered into covenant with the Jewish people, and this covenant endures. The people Israel lives. At the heart of the covenant is Torah, the way of life that forms a people. How one lives Torah, however, was and continues to be vigorously discussed, and diverse interpretations arose as they would in any community of faith with authoritative texts. Little editorial here. If there is any conflict in your denomination over what is the proper way to live, then that's precisely what I mean. We have authoritative texts, we have a scripture, but how we read those scriptures will be the source of much division among us as well as much unity. In particular, we now know, thanks to recent biblical scholarship, that Second Temple Judaism, I should tell you that simply refers to that time, the period roughly from, say, 500 before the Common Era, before Christ, to 70 of the first century when Jerusalem was destroyed by the Roman army under Titus. So it's roughly a 600-year period, 500 before Christ, not quite 100 after Christ. So that the Second Temple Judaism, this sentence is way too long, needs editing, the context for the teaching of Jesus, the Jew from Nazareth, was characterized by disparate or diverse and at times contentious schools of interpretation. Thus we might appropriately speak of Second Temple Judaisms. By analogy, we might say that in our time we have Christianities. We have the three great families, Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox. Within that, we have many variations on what it means to be a Christian. And if you've ever had to give a presentation to some group of people who sort of don't know anything about religion, and you're asked to do something like, well, what is Christianity? And what is it that Christians hold in common? We think, well, all right, well, believe in you. Well, no, it's then you start to look at some of the other traditions that aren't, you know, don't have a liturgical year or whatever. And you come down to some fairly few common factors, and yet we all go, so maybe it would be better to speak of Christianities that might, however, keep us too far away from the ideal of Christian unity. But at any rate, so there's a great deal of diversity in this, in Judaism of this period. This diversity suggests the importance of placing the teachings of Jesus and the early church in the matrix of Judaisms. We cannot neatly place Jesus within any single Judaism. For instance, while the reformist cast of his teaching bears similarities to the Pharisees, who are also a reform movement, some of his teaching shows a semblance to certain aspects of Essene thought. If that isn't written by an academic, I don't know what. Some of his teaching shows a semblance to certain aspects, but that's all you can say. You can't say more than that, because it's not as if there are all kinds of differences from the Essenes, by the way, are most likely the group that wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, or from whom we have the Dead Sea Scrolls, discovered in 1947. Now, one of the aspects of Essene thought was the sense that the world is rapidly coming to a close, and God and God's justice and in God's mercy will bring this creation to a close. That with them, it also had to do with the fact that they were the community of the new covenant and so forth. So that when Jesus speaks these kind of apocalyptic things that are, say, in the toward the end of the Gospels, usually that we read usually just before Advent begins, or even on the first Sundays of Advent, they bear a real similarity to some of the writings in the Dead Sea Scrolls. We simply do not know enough about first century Palestinian Judaism to situate Jesus assuredly vis-a-vis his contemporaries. We can, however, at least point to what seems characteristic of him. Oh, that's a variation on the old antiphons.
Well, I thought that was because you were Irish.
Yeah, but I'm not. So there goes that hypothesis. Okay. So, his teaching on love of enemies. See, this is what's characteristic of Jesus. It's not saying it's singular of him, that no one else in the first century taught this. But here you see love of enemies, a proclivity toward nonviolence, a compassion, a deep compassion for the marginal and the oppressed, an intimate relation with God, emphasis on foot washing and on service, period. Jesus preached the nearness of God's reign, and because God's reign was near, all human institutions, whether the rule of Rome or that great institution of Judaism, the temple. By the way, Second Temple Judaism is so called because the first temple had been destroyed in the exile, and under Ezra and Nehemiah, the temple was rebuilt. It was a very modest recreation or reconstruction until this great ruler came along in the late first century. Herod remodeled it to be one of the wonders of the world. And Jesus has a kind of ambivalence toward the temple. He seems probably to have gone up and offered sacrifice and so forth. He does have, there is this prophetic action in the temple that's hard to interpret. But he doesn't make a lot of credit. He doesn't seem to say much about it. Except that the temple ultimately will not survive. And, you know, really, in a sense, what will when God's reign comes? Jesus attracted a number of men and women as disciples. And their commitment, though often a wavering one, which I put in to make myself feel better, to following him, took on new power after some testified to seeing him alive after his crucifixion. I put seeing in quotation marks because the kind of seeing that they had after the resurrection is sort of qualitatively different. You know, for Mary of Magdala, she thinks he's the gardener. It's a more mysterious way of seeing him. I put it in quotation marks not because I doubt their testimony, but because it is the testimony of faith. He didn't appear back to Herod Antipas and say, "Here I am." He didn't go to Pontius Pilate and say, "You thought you'd gotten me," you know, so on and so forth. He appeared to people who could see him with the eyes of faith. their testimony that God had raised Jesus from the dead and that God had poured out the Spirit of Jesus on their community emboldened them to go on. Having found in Jesus' teaching and in the events of the Passion, Death, and Resurrection a startling and definitive revelation of God, they drew creatively from the wellsprings of Judaism in their teaching and preaching. Now that's an alternative to saying fulfillment language, that they experienced what for them was a startling revelation. It was for them definitive in the sense, although I shouldn't say definitive as if it happened in an instant, but definitive in the sense that they really felt that they had seen the face of God in Jesus. But when they went to teach this and to try to articulate what they had seen, their whole vocabulary, all of their imagery, their metaphors, their way of praying was only Jewish at the beginning. Jewish means a lot of things at this period. It doesn't exclude Hellenistic or Greek thought, because there were many Jews who were influenced by that. But that was their source, you know. Now, the resources of a rich heritage provided various images by which they expressed what they believed God had done in Jesus and what he was still doing among them. Jesus was God's anointed, God's word and wisdom made flesh, a prophet even greater than Moses, because Jesus embodied Torah. As one who had preached the reign of the sovereign God, he was the new David. That's why it's very difficult to teach the Gospels to people who know nothing about Moses and David and prophecy and so forth, because you can't present Jesus in those analogies or in those metaphors or images unless you know something about them originally. But I still think this is different from simply saying he fulfilled them all. They knew who Moses was, so a teacher or a preacher could do something with the life of Moses in relationship to Jesus. Now, on the other side here, to keep going, trying to be fair both to our origins in Judaism and to who we might be today. In their life together, the disciples layered their prayers, I'll come back to that for spirit, and their practices with what we've come to call Christian prayers, though of course there's nothing Christian at the explicit level about these prayers, and the hymns. So when you look at the Magnificat, Mary's prayer in Luke, it's really a very beautiful weave of Hannah's song and from some psalm texts, including some psalm texts that are not didn't make the final canon of the scriptures that we know about these psalms because they're included among the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's scarcely, if you will, an original word in Mary's prayer. Now, instead of that being a source of scandal, as if why didn't Mary think more creatively about responding to God's gift, what I think we have here is Luke places on Mary's lips what probably was a prominent prayer in his community. And she exemplifies Luke's praying community. And the kinds of, I think, when I read the Magnificat, one of the things that I think about is this probably is how one of the very first generations of my ancestors in faith prayed. And it's a very powerful testimony to the fact that God reverses things. The people who were in power wind up on the bottom, and the people who are lowly, get exalted, get raised. But you can also see, by the way, how it's a resurrection hymn. There's all kinds of raising and lowering language in it, and of course, for the post-resurrectional community, it makes a lot of sense. Same thing for the so-called Lord's Prayer or the Our Father. There's nothing specific, there's no Christian language in it. And it was, as the early teachers of the church talked about, it was the model prayer, it was the outline of how we are to pray. So the early Christians then layered their prayers that they already knew, the Shema, Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. Shema in Hebrew means listen, be attentive. It's the key prayer in Judaism. We know that in the first century that this was a central prayer You know that today, for instance, many Jews, observant Jews, will have on the doorposts of their home a mezuzah, which has within it, you know, the little, you know what I'm talking about, the little kind of cylinder tube. And inside the mezuzah, a hand-lettered scroll, very tiny Hebrew calligraphy, of the Shema and the blessings that go with the saying of the Shema. And we have, archaeologists have found those from first century. So I can't tell you that Mary and Joseph had a mezuzah on their doorpost, but it's likely. That is, that's what many would have had. Their practices now that they had learned from Judaism are now, in a sense, added to by Christian practices. So the breaking of the bread in memory of Jesus' breaking of the bread and the giving of the cup now comes to be added to what they did as Jews, which was going to the temple and offering praise and sacrifice. There's an emphasis in the teaching of Jesus on the sharing of goods in common. That had been part of some sectors of Judaism, but seems to become more characteristic of the earliest layers of the Christian community, at least some of them. And it never works so well in the Christian community either. When you read the first couple of chapters of Acts, it looks like a promising beginning. By the time you get to chapters 5 and 6, human nature has taken over. So God's covenant was made new among them. God's Spirit animated them, and there was a sense that old bones had been the recipients of new life. Now, what my way of talking about this is not simply to say, well, therefore we fulfill Judaism, but rather to say his Jewish believers added new dimensions to deeply rooted terms, titles, and practices. While their interpretations may not have convinced other Jews, they did not transgress the boundaries of Judaism. See what I'm saying? So there were lots of ways you could talk about God's activity in Second Temple Judaism, and the way that the first disciples talked about it, the way in which they embellished or added to Jewish prayers was quite in line with what happened among a lot of Jews. At this point, let's recognize that we also have bodies and take a little stand-up break because the heat gets a bit much. So. I know you stick to the chairs and...
That's the old one, the new one.
Okay. Should I stop here for some questions or clarification, or do you want me to complete the count? I'm easy either way.
Hey, go ahead.
Go ahead. All right. As many Gentiles became followers of Jesus, so probably this happens now, especially in the 50s and 60s, and then beyond that, it's even greater, the movement of the Gentiles, the non-Jews. I told this the other day, it's a great line, use it with a new group. I was once asked in a class where I taught for many years at Boston College, I was once asked by a young, very serious undergraduate, fortunately at the break of the class, if I could clarify again the difference between a Jew and a Gentile. You never know. You have to be very careful with your language. I think spelling and sex education should be a requisite for study of New Testament. So, as many Gentiles, spelled without the I in the middle and the other ending, became followers of Jesus, the religious practices that had maintained the community's boundaries, the identity of the community, you have certain practices that characterize who you are. In the case of Judaism of the first century, that meant circumcision for males, dietary laws, which I think of as sort of a subset of household economics, for those of you who have read Practicing Our Faith, and the role of the temple. those communities' boundaries, or those boundaries, were passionately disputed among the believers in Jesus. And I'll say a little bit more about that tomorrow. In other words, what did it mean to be one in Christ Jesus? If a Gentile comes in, if we're all believers in Jesus who have been shaped and formed by Judaism, that's the world that we breathed. That's how we know God. And we come to believe that Jesus is for us now the definitive revelation of Torah. This, we have seen God's face in Jesus, or however we want to express it. And then into our community and filling in these chairs are these people who have not had any deep religious formation. So right away, of course, we feel a certain sense of, we need to teach them. Although some of them may have been, first century Judaism had a lot of people who were never had become Jews, but who were very attracted by the ethical teaching of Judaism. Okay? So the big question for our community, let's say that the last four chairs here are occupied by males. So the question in the community is, well, do they have to be circumcised? Now, we might say this is sort of a non-important issue, but remember, this is one of the identity markers. In a very literal sense, it's an identity marker. We don't know the origins of this. We keep among us, we order our household economics in a certain way, that we have certain foods that we do not eat, or we have certain foods we do not mix. Okay? Now, the Gentiles don't have any of that, so do they have to do that? Or do we have to have separate eating groups? Do we have to have a first setting for believers in Jesus who were Jewish and a second setting for the Gentiles? And what I'm setting you up for is this great clash between Peter and James on the one hand and Paul on the other. Read all about it in the letter to the Galatians. The conflict at Antioch will come tomorrow, and we'll talk a little bit about it. So when